This is a recording of the audit hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on April 23rd, 2014. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Let a similar procedure be adopted with respect to other commission processes, including audits. Under the program for audit hearings, which went into effect on July 27, 2009, political committees may request a hearing before the commission prior to the commission's adoption of a final audit report. If two or more commissioners approve such a request, the committee will have the opportunity to present oral arguments to the commission directly, and the commissioners may ask relevant questions. Hearings are voluntary, and the commission draws no adverse inference based on a committee's request for or waiver of such a hearing. On February 6, 2014, the Audit Division sent a copy of its draft final audit report to the Democratic Party of Illinois, as well as a copy of the relevant legal analysis. By a letter dated February 24, counsel, Mr. Svoboda, requested a hearing on behalf of the committee, and on February 26 of this year, the commission granted that request. Representing the committee today is Mr. Brian Svoboda of the firm Perkins Coie. Mr. Svoboda, for today's hearing, you may have up to 20 minutes to make an opening statement and make your presentation. Following your presentation, the commissioners, the general counsel, and the staff director will have an opportunity to ask you questions. At the end of the hearing, you will then have 10 minutes to make a closing statement. Because this hearing is being held in open session, there will be no written transcript. However, audio recordings will be made of open session hearings in accordance with the commission's current practice and placed on the FEC's website. Mr. Svoboda, it's good to see you here today. Welcome.
Thank you.
You may proceed with your opening presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the Commission for allowing me to be here, and I'd like to thank the staff as well for assisting and facilitating in this process. We're here in the final stage of an audit on behalf of the Democratic Party of Illinois, with which we've cooperated with the auditors all along. And we're here about $75,800 that the party has already, at an earlier stage in the audit, transferred to its non-federal account. So you might reasonably ask, why are we here? We're here because the legal issues involved with finding three over the $75,800 have not been clearly focused throughout the audit process, that are extremely consequential, not simply to this committee, but to other committees, particularly party committees, that raise funds in tandem with their legislative leaders and their adherents. And it's important for the commission, we think, to get it right. So where this began, first, I guess, some background on the Democratic Party of Illinois. We are obviously the state Democratic Party in Illinois. I think the record shows very strongly that we are very, very much non-federally focused. I mean, not obviously to the exclusion of federal activity. We engage in that to a significant degree. But we're rather the opposite, I think, of what Congress imagined when they passed McCain-Feingold and imposed the federal election activity restrictions. In other words, state parties that served as glove puppets for their federal candidates to do their bidding with indifference to the state legislatures and governors and dog catchers of the world. The Democratic Party of Illinois is quite the opposite. Our chair is a state legislative leader. It spends extensively in state legislative races and in down ballot races. I think it's fair to say that that's the bulk of the party's program during the audit period in question. The party's actually different from a lot of state parties in that it actually has an incentive to use Levin funds, which is a burdensome and cumbersome process that many state parties shun because, frankly, there's not much in it for them. In the case of a party like Illinois, where you're trying to get out the vote for a state legislative candidate who happens to share the ballot with a federal candidate who may or may not be tantamount to election in that same state, you're going to have an incentive to raise and spend those Levin funds. So that's an example of where the non-federal focus of the Democratic Party of Illinois meshes perhaps sometimes uneasily with the federal restrictions that the commission's been charged charged with enforcing after McCain-Feingold. We were selected for audit during the 2010 process, and we cooperated with the auditors throughout the process. We made all of our records available on request for review inspection, including those records pertaining to the state party's non-federal activities. We complied with all of the auditors' recommendations with respect to the amendments of our report and the other financial steps that needed to be taken in connection with the audit. There was no finding significantly in the audit of a cumulative underpayment from the federal account, so the audit report that is before you now presents no issue that the state party somehow in the main subsidized its federal activity impermissibly with non-federal activities. And also significantly, there's no finding before you now that the state party received prohibited contributions into its federal accounts, such as corporate contributions, union treasury contributions, or contributions that exceeded the federal limit. And this audit comes in a moment where the state party has worked with the commission and worked internally to try to strengthen its compliance activities. So, for example, last fall, I went to Illinois myself to help deliver a training for the state party's employees on the applicable FEC restrictions. It was very exciting. I went to Lincoln's tomb and got to rub the nose on a statue in front of there, which I understand is the tradition in Springfield. So we felt we had his blessing for the training. So, this issue, how did this issue pop up and how did we get here? It began with the auditor's reviews of batch deposits in the course of the audit process, and they identified, right before the ACID conference, they identified $89,918 that they thought had been raised through fundraising events that ought to have been allocated and disclosed on the H2 schedule. And we were presented with a list of these events, and we were asked to respond to them. And right at the outset, we had what we knew was going to be an unusual issue in this audit because, as I mentioned before, the chair of our party organization is a state legislative leader. He raises funds for his own campaign. He raises funds for the caucus committees in his state. And from time to time, that gives a financial interest for others who are interested more broadly in his activities to want to support the party as well, which should be of no surprise or of no moment. The same might be true for Speaker Boehner as he raises money for the Ohio Democratic Party. The same might be true, you know, for Senator Reid as he raises money for the Nevada Democratic Party. So you had an instance where among the events that were identified by the auditors at this stage in the ACID conference were four fundraising events that were actually sponsored by the chairman's own non-federal campaign committee, and where the events elicited some amount of checks that were payable to the state Democratic Party and deposited into the state Democratic Party's federal account. And again, to emphasize checks which bore, you know, no indicia of noncompliance with the source restrictions or contribution limits. They weren't corporate checks. They weren't union checks. They weren't excessive individual checks. They were simply checks payable to the Democratic Party's account. The auditors also flagged three other events that were state party fundraising events that were organized to raise funds for the state party's non-federal account. And again, it goes back to one of the foundational points that I began with at the beginning. The state party is very interested in its non-federal activities. It's a prime focus of its activities, and it's interested in supporting those activities to the maximum extent possible. And then and then other checks which were associated with other events in ways that weren't clear to us, at least, from the presentations, you know, that we received at the time of the ACID conference. So we responded at the time, indicating that, you know, broadly speaking, the fact that the party received and batched in the context of other non-federal activities shouldn't take these events and otherwise expose them to allocation and disclosure on the H2 schedule. I think we flagged actually in the response to the ACID conference that some number of the events actually were on the H2 schedule, and there we went after responding to the ACID conference. So then we come to the interim audit report, and the number is down to $75,800, which is the amount that we're talking about today, against a total universe, by the way, to give you a sense of context, a total universe raised in connection through these events identified by the auditors of $1,103,925. So again, you're talking about $75,800 deposited in the federal account versus more than $1.1 million raised for non-federal activities. So it gives you a sense of the focus of these activities. And this was where, frankly, the audit report really got our attention, because three legal issues, not just one, but three, were now clearly raised for us. The first was the application of the Commission's joint fundraising rules, the imputation being that if these events were held to raise non-federal funds, for example, the legislative leader's own event for his own campaign, and yet elicited some amount of checks for the state party's federal account, that this triggered the joint fundraising rules under 102.17. The second was the allocation issue, which was, again, the one that had been presented to us at the ACID conference. And the third was the notice provision of Section 102.5 of the Commission's regulations. And you'll recall that's the regulation that prescribes that for funds to be eligible for deposit into a federal account, they have to be either designated for a federal election, made in response to a solicitation saying that the funds are going to be used in a federal election, or that the donors have to be told that their funds are being subject to the limits and restrictions of the Act. And the purpose of this at bottom, the reason the Commission wrote this rule in the first place, was fundamentally as an anti-fraud requirement, a way of making sure that the donors weren't being bamboozled or abused in the way that their funds were being collected and deposited. So there was a rather famous MER I know the commissioners are familiar with from the mid-1990s, where you had a national party that was raising joint federal and non-federal checks, or perhaps in the mind of the Commission, just non-federal checks, taking the first $20,000 off the top and depositing it in the federal account. The donors were unhappy about that. The Commission was unhappy about that. And the Commission, you know, enforced this rule to try to prevent things like that, you know, from occurring. So these were the issues that were presented to us in the interim audit report. And our response, again, was, first, the joint fundraising rules shouldn't be implicated by this. It cannot be, for example, that John Boehner engages in joint fundraising committee between the Ohio Democratic Party and the National Republican Congressional Committee because somebody comes to him at an Ohio Democratic Party event and gives him a check, you know, for the NRCC. The Commission's never enforced the joint fundraising rules that way. It's looked for purposeful, organized ways to try to raise funds together in ways that have, you know, tried to pretend that you have two events at the same time, but really, in fact, you have just one. I mean, so for example, you look to the MER 5780 on the Pennsylvania Republican Party, where you saw just that set of circumstances. You saw the state Republican Party on the one hand purporting to hold an event featuring President Bush at 10 a.m. at the, you know, at a nice house, and you saw the Senator Santorum purporting to hold an event at 10 a.m. with President Bush at that same house, and the Commission, you know, one might argue sensibly concluded these are in fact just one event when they were organized together on the back end and simply billed and presented separately. I mean, not the case here, not what was presented here. And indeed, if you read the interim audit report, the auditors seemed at some level, I think, to acknowledge that. They said that it appears that the solicitations for these fundraising events were not intended to raise money for the federal account. So it was a question of how do we apply the rules to this particular, you know, sort of situation. And so we had a strong issue with the joint application of the joint fundraising rules, the potential application of that. We had a strong issue with the application of the allocation rules, again, you know, on that same sort of theory, which is, does a state party have to put something on its H-2 schedule in any circumstance when some amount of federal checks are being issued into the account, or is the rule intended more broadly to make sure that the party's not subsidizing its federal activity impermissibly with its non-federal activity? And then lastly, with the notice requirement, you know, there was no genuine presentation in the interim audit report of any suggestion that the donors were somehow misled or that they were somehow deceived, you know, in this process. So that prompted our response to the interim audit report, and then that was where, and that's where things stand at the present moment. We transferred, and here I want to emphasize, we went ahead and transferred the $75,800 in response to the interim audit report, and we did that for two reasons. The first was we'd cooperated fully with the auditors to date, and we didn't want to stop now. It was important for the party that we work collaboratively and we meet their recommendations, and we didn't want to be in a position where I would be sitting here at the table before you today saying that we hadn't. The second, and it goes again to one of the foundational points I made at the beginning, is the party had ample use for this non-federal money. I mean, we were active and engaged in supporting non-federal candidates for office. So in the broader scheme of things, you know, to be without that $75,800 in the non-federal account was it was compatible with what the party's other, you know, needs, you know, were at that present moment supporting its non-federal candidates. So then we received the draft audit report, and we came to you, you know, with the request for hearing, you know, precisely because we wanted to avoid a suggestion of noncompliance that we would have to contend with later. And that's the real reason why I'm here today, having complied with this recommendation, you know, despite the fact that the party had serious reservations about it and the application of these rules in this context. We did not want to be in a situation where later we're having to answer to the commission about this activity, and we thought that this was an issue, you know, that should be joined now. Now, I had the opportunity to read yesterday the final memo that the Audit Division and the staff has sent to the Commission about the matter, and it seems there's two main impressions I draw from it. The first is, if I read it correctly and understand it correctly, the issue that is now before the Commission is solely the issue of the notice requirement to the donors. In other words, were the funds eligible for deposit in the federal account because the conditions of Section 102.5 were met? It appears from the auditor's memorandum, at least as I read it, that the issues of joint fundraising and the issues of allocation are not on the table, although they remain referred to in the draft final audit report. I assume that's because of the ordinary course of how the Commission and the staff prepare draft final audit reports, that issues are surfaced in field work, they're surfaced in the exit conference, they persist through the drafts, and ultimately, you know, the draft reads like kind of a narrative. You get to the end and you see what happened. Those issues persist in the draft final audit report, but I read the memo to mean that what we're really talking about here is Section 102.5. And to dwell on that for a moment, this is a very important point. Section 102.5 is being applied and enforced here as a source restriction. In other words, it is an independent legal restriction, the way it's proposed to be applied to you, on whether the party can or cannot deposit this money into the federal account. Its functional effect on the party is no different than 441B and the prohibition on corporate contributions. It's no different than 441AA and the $10,000 limit on the amounts we receive. It's really a binary question we've been presented with, which is, it's not like the best efforts requirement where I have to say the magic words and keep a record of it, and I face potential liability later if I haven't, you know, used the magic words and kept the record. It's not a record-keeping requirement. It's actually a condition on deposit into the account. And one question I think the Commission needs to consider is, can 102.5 be enforced that way in the judicial environment that we're in now, where we've been told 3 weeks ago that the only state interest to support the receipt and deposit of contributions is the avoidance of actual or apparent quid pro quo corruption? I would have liked to have been able to write that in my response to the draft audit report, but the opinion didn't come out until later. But it's a real question, I think, about how the rule can be applied in this situation. The second, I think, also, and maybe an easier way for the commissioners to approach this question and resolve it, is Section 102.5 doesn't prescribe exclusive means for compliance. And the fact of the matter is, with the bulk of the $75,800, we don't have a clear, unambiguous record of what the donors actually were told, which could have been verbally or which could have been through other means. But we don't have a clear record of that. I wish we did, I mean, 3 years later. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we don't. So the question is whether there's an adequate, you know, factual basis, you know, for a finding here. The last point about the memo that I'd like, you know, to make as well is, you know, it goes to the fact that we've already transferred these funds and we've already dealt with them. One of the arguments that the staff have made to the commission was, quote, although the Democratic Party of Illinois has questioned whether these funds were part of the fundraising event, it has included these funds in the total amount that was transferred. Here they're talking about one particular event where we had a factual issue with whether the funds actually were raised through the event in question or not. And it's kind of a damned if we do, damned if we don't situation. We complied with the auditor's recommendation so that we wouldn't have to hear later that we hadn't, but having complied with the auditor's recommendation, recommendations, we now hear that it's a tacit admission that we did wrong to begin with. And so it's an uncomfortable situation, you know, for this committee to be with. I want to talk lastly, if I have time remaining, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. You've got about 7 minutes.
Oh, great. I want to talk lastly about one of those events, and it helps sum up, I think, how we got here and what the issue is actually about. Again, this goes back to batch deposits that the party made. It would receive checks over a period of time, it would batch them together, it would fill out a deposit slip, and it would deposit them in the bank. And so the question was, how do you infer from the batch deposit slips which funds were raised in connection with which events? So one of the events at issue in this matter, and you'll find it, it's the addendum that the staff provided you along with my response, the Exhibit A to that response, you know, was an event called the Janssen event. It was an event held on September 28th, 2010, by an individual who was an attorney for a local building and construction trades union in Illinois. And so if you look, you know, on page, you know, one of that exhibit, you'll see the contributions that were included in the batch that included the contributions for the Janssen event. They summed to $23,050, and there's a total of 21 contributions. Now, if you look closely at that, it's like the old Sesame Street game of one of these things is not like the other. I mean, you look at the top 11 contributions. You start with Bill Ledley, and you go down to Stephen Williams. You see a bunch of pretty small contributions, and they're all raised on September 28th, September 29th. There's one from, like, September 22nd. They're all on the same day. And then you look at the next 10 contributions. They span from September 2nd to September 21st. They're all in larger contributions, and they all bear indicia of having been raised by the Trial Lawyers Association in the state. And so just looking at the batch and looking at the checks, there's no uniform reason to treat all of these contributions together or to assume that they were all raised through the same event. I believe the auditors did because Janssen hosted the September 28th event. He was an attorney. These other contributions were raised by trial lawyers. They're attorneys too, and all attorneys must love each other, and hence they raise funds together. But the look at the timing of the contribution and the backup and the indicia don't actually support the supposition that all of these funds were actually raised, you know, through the same event. And that's an issue that we raised in response to this, and it's a really a core problem with this finding. I mean, it's a reflection of the limitation you have on the audit process, which is you're dealing with activities that happened long ago. You're dealing with records that are open to multiple interpretations from which multiple inferences can be drawn, and it's not to belittle in any way the auditor's task. The auditor's task, I mean, as an auditor would see it, is to draw the negative inference and to try to disprove it. But that's the opposite of how, you know, we would propose to approach, you know, issues in this matter. And we would suggest the preponderance of the evidence suggests that the universe of contributions in this particular event is, in fact, you know, smaller than proposed, and that calls, you know, into some doubt, you know, the financial amount of the entire finding. So what we would ask the commission to do is to modify finding three or remove finding three so that certainly there's not a suggestion that the party engaged in prohibited joint fundraising, which I don't think the application of the commission's rules in the past have support. Not to suggest that these funds were ineligible for deposit in the federal account, because after all, they did meet the source restrictions and contribution limits of the Act. And to realize that there's at the very least a debatable basis over whether the universe of this money, which was small to begin with, $75,800 out of $1.1 million to begin with, is in fact almost certainly larger than what the true universe, you know, of contributions are. The commission very shortly is going to be holding a town meeting, I understand, for state parties and the compliance burdens that state parties have. And this is an example of one of the forks in the road, you know, the commission has. It can either make it harder for state parties to engage in concerted political activities with their leaders while complying with the rules that, you know, ought to be applying to the financing of their activities, or it can look for opportunities to construe these rules as narrowly as possible and make it more difficult for the same interaction, even against a backdrop where the record shows fairly clearly that there was no federal underpayment, that there was no issue of prohibited contributions, and that there was no genuine question of the donor's intent. And so this is why we would respectfully request that finding three be removed. And I appreciate the Commission's time.
Mr. Verbota, thank you very much. It was a very helpful presentation, and I'm sure there are going to be some interest among commissioners. I'll open the floor to questions. If anybody has any questions for Mr. Verbota. Reliable first question. Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm an engaged commissioner, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I want to confirm with the staff, because I want to make sure we're all talking about the same thing. So is it also the staff's understanding that there really isn't any issue on the joint fundraising or the allocation? Those issues are,
yes.
Are gone?
Yes.
Yes? On the other side? Yes?
That's
okay,
correct.
Good. Check, check.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
But it's still in the audit report.
Yes, it's still in the audit report because, you know, when we were looking at it, we were seeing these events, and at the time we wrote the finding, we weren't sure if there may be some sort of joint fundraising event that we needed to see the agreements on. So that was sort of early in the process.
But it could now come out before when we get to the final.
We can certainly revise that at this point in time, yes.
Oh, please continue.
Thanks. So that's good. So we have agreement on that much. So let me ask you, Mr. Swoboda, about the 102.5 issue. So I gather that what you're saying is that these were otherwise non-federal fundraising events, and somebody said, "Oh, while I'm here, I've got a check for you for the party."
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In the main, that's what happened.
We don't know at this point, I gather, whether it was the intention of the donor to make that contribution to the federal account or the non-federal account?
Well, part of the problem that we have, you know, with the bulk of these checks is that you have a check that's made payable to the Democratic Party of Illinois for $500, or you have a check that's made payable to the Democratic Party of Illinois for $1,000, and the check is written by, you know, Lee Goodman or Ellen Weintraub. And so that's what the check says, and that's what the backup says. And we know that the check was deposited in the federal account. You know, the question is, what do we know about the intervening steps between issuance and receipt and deposit of check?
And the answer is we don't. We just don't have a lot of information on that.
Right.
Right. But they are on their face compliant with all the rules for a federal committee, for the federal account.
Yeah, they're compliant with the source restrictions and the contribution right. limits of the Act. So it's not from, for example, Ellen Weintraub PC.
Right. And it's not for, you know, well, I won't get into the amounts.
$40,000 or $100,000.
So it's your position then that 102.5 doesn't apply? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think
I just want to make sure I understand what your argument is.
Our main position is that the draft final audit report doesn't present a clear basis for a violation of 102.5. It doesn't show that the contributions at issue failed to meet the requirements of the regulation. It looks to fundraising solicitations that accompany some of the checks in the batches, which didn't contain the 102.5 language, so we stipulate to that. But we don't know otherwise, you know, what the communications, you know, were, you know, back and forth with virtually all of these contributions with the donors. I mean, there's a couple contributions in the record where one where there's actually an express designation for the federal account. There is another contribution where there is an express designation for the non-federal account. So in that case, it's a contribution that we transferred, and appropriately so. But in the main, the contributions are just Delphic in terms of what the fact record is, you know, to support them.
So do you think that Is the argument that 102.5 doesn't apply to these, or we just don't know whether it was or wasn't complied with?
Well, I mean, first, I think the question before the commission is whether there's facts available to support that within, with respect to the $75,800, that the regulation was not complied with. And I think the best answer that the commission can give with almost all of these contributions, again, setting aside the one on one side, one on the other, with almost all of these contributions is that the records, that we just don't know, that the records don't show what was communicated to the donors at the time. So from that, first, I would argue, is there a factual basis to support a finding of a violation that the party deposited a contribution that it wasn't legally able to deposit? And then the second question, and this is where I think I could tell you were listening skeptically to it. You know, the question is, there's a real question, I think, that would not have occurred to me before 3 weeks ago, whether the commission actually could constitutionally place a condition on the deposit of a check based on the failure to keep, you know, that particular sort of paperwork. So in other words, if I go to Commissioner Ellen Weintraub and ask for a $500 check to the Democratic Party of Illinois, and she says, sure, I'd be happy to give, and I deposit into my federal account, and then 5 years later the commission comes saying, you couldn't deposit that check into your federal account. You didn't tell her that those funds were going to be used in connection with a federal election. You didn't tell her that her contributions were made to the prohibitions and restrictions of the Act. You didn't tell her that her funds would be used in connection with federal election. So you have to give that $500 back. We will not simply fine you for having to make the statement, as we would, for example, with not making best efforts, or as we would, you know, with otherwise complying with the record-keeping requirement of the contribution. That contribution is illegal. You have to send that contribution back. And so, having read McCutcheon 3 weeks ago and seeing that the only basis to impose restrictions on the receipt of contributions is the avoidance of actual or apparent quid pro quo corruption, then is that state interest satisfied by a mandatory refund rule? Now, that is not, I would suggest, need to be the primary basis by which the commission, or even a necessary basis by which the commission disposes of this matter. But it shows how there is a consequence to the application of this rule to state parties in this context that the commission is going to deal with at some point down the road.
But nobody's saying that this money had to be refunded to donors. I mean, what the committee very cooperatively did was just to take the issue off the table. They said, we'll just move it into the non-federal account.
Well, sure. I mean, that's correct. But, I mean, at some level, I mean, at one level, the effect is the same. You have a contribution that otherwise, but for the notice requirement, would be eligible for use in influencing federal elections, and but for the failure to document compliance with the notice requirement, it's no longer eligible for use in connection with federal elections. So whether you transfer it to the non-federal account, whether you refund and resolicit, whatever intervening steps you say, the effect in the first instance is the same. You have a contribution that would have been eligible for use in a federal election that's no longer eligible for use in a federal election.
Well, but that assumes that it was eligible for use in a federal election in the first instance. So it's a somewhat circular argument. I agree with you. We don't have to reach the McCutcheon issue, and I don't intend to. I'm pretty sure McCutcheon didn't talk about Section 102.5 of our regulations. So I just don't think we need to go there. But the other issue that you raise is an interesting one and an important one, and is one that's come up in a variety of other contexts in the audit, in other audits, which is what happened. I mean, what auditors do, as you know, is they go and they look for documents. They're looking for a paper trail. That's what they do. That's the only thing they can do, is to look for a paper trail to document that rules were complied with. So what happens when that paper trail doesn't exist? And this argument that, well, if the paper trail doesn't exist, then you can't establish a violation because there is zero paper trail. Nobody knows, actually, whether there was a conversation, whether there was any kind of designation. At this point, it's years later. I appreciate the difficulty of that in and of itself. But we don't know what happened. So when there is no record, what does is the commission foreclosed from making a finding when there is no record? I mean, the fact of there being no record may itself be an indicia that the appropriate records never existed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's some commissioners have talked about this in terms of the burden. You know, the commission has to prove, they have the burden of proof, so they have to find some records. But, of course, the commission doesn't have these records. It's only the committee that would have these records.
Right.
There's no way that we could create these records for you if they were never created in the first instance. So, I mean, if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're raising is a bigger issue that has come up before the commission in many instances before. And that is a separate issue from whether 102.5, right, putting aside the constitutionality argument, which is creative and clever, and I appreciate it, but putting that one aside,
bless you.
I expect no less. It's not your position. Is it your position that it doesn't apply, or that we just don't know whether it was complied with?
My position is that there's not a sufficient factual basis to assert a violation of the law by the committee, and here. Here's the perspective from which the party is coming from. There's a difference between a finding saying, we think you may not have met the notice requirement, and we would encourage you to meet the notice requirement going forward. Revise your practices, revise your procedures, as indeed this party is already working on doing, to make sure you comply with the notice requirements going forward. That's one thing. The other alternative is the way the audit process normally works, which is, we find that you didn't comply with the notice requirements, so please step outside with Mr. Holloway and his colleagues in the Office of General Counsel, and you'll have a conversation with them in another context, the enforcement context. And that's why
Holloway's not in the enforcement division. You don't have to worry about that.
And that's why we're here. We don't think that there's a sufficient factual or legal basis for that denouement to this matter. We're willing to continue to do what we've done thus far in this audit process, which is to conform to the auditor's recommendations, and indeed, you know, to the degree that there's other circumstances where there's things to be discussed later, I mean, that, you know, that is what it is. But with respect to this particular issue, there's not a basis for future enforcement based on this issue, and that is a urgent reason why I'm here.
Okay, so that's the crux of it. It's not an intellectual argument about the finding. You're concerned about possible enforcement ramifications.
Yeah, I don't forsake the intellectual argument, but there is a heavy practical dimension to why I'm here. That's correct. And I hasten to emphasize that's not because of anxiety about the party's substantive position. It's just realism about how the commission has dealt with this process in the past.
Gotcha.
Any other commissioners have questions? No.
Let me understand. You would find acceptable language in an audit report that simply notes that $75,000 was raised during this period of time without contemporaneous documentation of the notices having been provided as a factual statement with no actual finding based on that.
I think that's correct, Commissioner.
Mm-hmm. Is your evidentiary problem, by the way, I no means intend to suggest that we should shift the burden to the party. That's mm-hmm. actually contrary to my position. But there is, to me, just knowing how political parties operate and looking at the dimensions of this, $75,000 out of $1.1 million, there to me is some evidence that there was some contemporaneous understanding. I mean, 102.5 doesn't necessarily say you have to have it in written form. A lot of fundraising happens person to person.
Right.
Oral solicitation.
Right.
And I think that happens when the party chair is at a state event and people walk up and say, you know, I really want to help the federal efforts. Can you send my money, you know, to the federal effort?
Right.
So when I see 75 of 1.1 million being diverted into the, or excuse me, deposited into the federal account, you know, I can think of many explanations. And one of them is that there was some contemporaneous understanding under 102.5 that the contributions were designated, maybe not in writing, but maybe verbally, for the federal account. In fact, the dimension, why send 75? Why not send more? Unless, of course, you know, unless there is some explanation that, well, gee, there were $72,000 worth of debts in the federal account, and we just decided it would be convenient to do that. But to me, there is some evidence that there was some designation of the federal account, some contemporaneous evidence, and that's the circumstantial evidence.
Right.
Have you been able, and again, I'm not shifting the burden to you at all, and if this were referred to enforcement, I would not deign to shift the burden to you in the absence of the contemporaneous evidence here. It's the government's burden to prove.
Right.
But just to sort of help us understand the context,
sure.
In discussing with your clients, would they say that they sent $75,000 of $1.1 million to the federal account because they had an understanding that it was intended for the federal account?
I think they understood that the funds were appropriate for deposit in the federal account, yeah. Mm-hmm. And as far as how they raised the funds, I think you need to divide it into, you know, four buckets. I mean, the first and I think largest bucket is checks that are just simply made payable to the party with no annotation, you know, no, you know, instruction. And that, Commissioner, is where you may well have had, I mean, I can't say one way or the other whether they did or they didn't, but it's entirely possible that those sorts of communications, you know, occurred, you know, on the back end. It's entirely possible also that somebody simply said, I want to help support the party, and they wrote a check that was federally permissible, and the party took it and deposited it in the federal account. Your second bucket, somewhat smaller, is checks, you know, that are given in response to non-federal solicitations where they're dealing with the state law donor card, which is just different, you know, from the federal donor card. And again, it's a federally permissible intent, no direct communication from the donor saying, but this has to go in the state account. You know, you have to give it to the state account because I'm worried about my federal aggregate limit, or I'm worried about whether I'm maxed out. So no indication with that. You know, your third very, very, very small universe, I'm aware of one check that falls in this category where there's actually an express designation for the federal account, and it's on a letter accompanying the check. And the fourth very, very, very small category, again, I'm aware of one check that falls in this category, is check with a record saying this is to be used for non-federal activities. So I think those are the four universes of contributions that you're dealing with. An important policy question for the Commission as it deals with this state party and other state parties going forward is, what do you do with, you know, bucket number, you know, one, which is somebody just writes a check to the California Democratic Party, or somebody writes a check to the Massachusetts Democratic Party, and it's within the federal limits, it's within the federal restrictions. And how, in what circumstances does the Commission aggressively and offensively enforce the 102.5 notice requirement? When do they determine that the requirement affirmatively hasn't been met and the party can't use those funds for federal activities? And lastly, I think as I talk about my four buckets here, Commissioner, it's important to understand one thing that goes, I think, within all these buckets, which is you don't have a record in this audit that the donors were misled as they were in past, you know, MERS where the Commission has enforced 102.5 and its progenitors. So there aren't people who write $100,000 checks and had the first 10 skimmed off the top and deposited into the federal account. That's not the facts of this matter.
Commissioner Walter.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your excellent presentation. That's very good. I'm interested, before we, what I'd like to do is ask the audit to comment on any of the comments that we've heard so far before you leave the dais so that we can actually have a conversation here and see if in fact, we're really getting to a point where we could work something out here.
Do you need a minute? Okay.
Thank you. We'd like to see if in that third bucket, if you could provide us more specifics. You had stated that there was express designation with a letter for deposit in the federal account. It would be great if we had specifics concerning that.
Sure. I'm recalling the check and having difficulty finding it. It was a federal PAC check that I believe was received in the fall of 2010. And I don't know if it was in the materials that we received in response to the ACID conference or whether it was materials we developed with respect to the Janssen batch later. Actually, it wouldn't be the Janssen batch because it wasn't a federal. May I take that back and email that to you when I get back?
Sorry. I'm sorry I got distracted. I just wanted to make sure that we were on a line of communication that was constructive here. Kruzawa, are you happy with the comments? I was reading something else, and I apologize.
I think he's going to get back to us on that. Okay. We had one outstanding question. As Commissioner Weintraub articulated, it's very difficult from an auditing perspective when you come in. You can't audit verbal agreements. You can't audit verbal agreements, and so it's very difficult from our perspective. We just go through the paperwork that's there.
I don't dispute that that's all an audit can look at. However, a party can represent that there was an understanding. And much party fundraising does occur verbally and orally. There are understandings that develop between people, and they're, you know, especially if there are sophisticated party donors. Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. Mr. Sloboda, what do you propose the commission do for in the future, not necessarily related to this audit, perhaps, but for the checks that are given to state parties in the first category that you mentioned? They're simply payable to the state party, and there's none of the three conditions in 102.5 are met.
I think one course of action for the commission is to require, you know, as has happened sometimes with redesignation issues, some sort of clear written communication to the donor of how their funds have been treated, so that their funds have been deposited in the federal account. The donor has the opportunity to seek a refund if the donor wishes to do that. But you achieve what is fundamentally, I think, the interest of the rule, which is to have transparency in the dealing with the donor about how their funds have been used. I think that's a requirement that if the commission were to review the rule or its enforcement of the rule, could be met as easily, you know, within some reasonable time after the fact as it is before.
Do you even think that they should have to do that? Because to me it seems pretty reasonable that someone who's writing just a general check to a party under the limits, even though some parties are more state-specific than others, I think it's pretty obvious that they're concerned about all of the candidates on the ballot from top to bottom, and it seems reasonable that you would want to contribute at least some, or if not all, to the federal account unless the donor requests otherwise.
I think it would be easier for the commission to justify an approach like that than to justify an absolute non-deposit prohibition. I think you could argue that such a after-the-fact requirement could be supported, you know, by other interests surrounding the record-keeping and reporting obligations rather than simply a burdening on the contribution itself. I think it would be easier to support it that way. I'm not sure it's necessary.
And it's also not in the rule.
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
I mean, if you come from Virginia, people give during off years, odd years, they know their money's going to the, you know, to the state elections. And if you give during an even number year, you pretty much know your money is headed toward that Senate race or that congressional race that year.
Right.
So, you know, in states where it's mixed, there are probably people who are giving with intent for one or either, you know, in their mind.
Right.
So I don't know that having it in writing every time necessarily wags the whole rule here.
Right.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is somewhat along the lines of Commissioner Hunter's. In terms of the application of 102.5 in this particular audit, I just want to make sure that I understand and am clear on the argument that you're making. It sounds as if you're saying that in terms of its application here, that there really shouldn't be a finding under 102.5 in the absence of evidence that there was any intent to mislead, that there was that there were impermissible funds either from impermissible sources or in amounts that exceed the applicable contribution limits, or that they were otherwise acting contrary to the intent of the donor, that like I said, in the absence of evidence that any of those conditions applied, then a finding that there was a violation of 102.5 really shouldn't occur.
Well, I think that's correct. Correct, Commissioner.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
That's correct.
On what you've been saying. Thanks.
We have five more minutes. If there are any other questions or comments, Commissioner Weintraub.
Yeah, I just want to. This may be a question more for my colleagues, although I'm happy to hear from Mr. Swoboda as well. I mean, here's the problem, is there, and I'm not, I think perhaps the chairman has outlined a possible way to go forward on this, that there might be a description that says we don't have this documentation and perhaps not a finding. I'm open to discussing that as a way forward in this. But you know, in general, we've got a requirement in the rules that says there has to be notice.
Actually, where does it say there has to be notice? I'm because I am reading 102.5,
right.
Subpart A2, I believe.
Yeah.
And it says before it's deposited or is received, contributions designated for the federal account. Now, that
could
be from the donor.
It could be.
That could be
absolutely.
From, you know, that could be donor directed right there. And there's an or for others are notices.
Right.
And that's where what I'm getting at is there are, you know, I mean, we've all been, in a prior life, we've all been to fundraisers. We know how it's done. And lots of checks are handed to that party chairman, you know, just saying, hey, I want to help this year. Now, in Virginia, I know what that means if it's an even number year. There's some ambiguity in 48 other states. there are lots of handshake arrangements and discussions that are had. And just looking at the prima facie dimensions here, I'm saying, well, they made some cut of, you know, there was some rationale that went into $75,000. And I think
the problem is we just don't know.
Right.
It's a dearth of information. And I don't think, and while I think that's, it may well be true that some or perhaps all of these were the result of oral discussions where there was either the designation or some acknowledgement that it's like, oh, thank you very much. I'm going to put this in our federal account since it appears to be compliant with all the federal. I mean, that could have happened. The problem is we don't know. And I don't think Mr. Swoboda is suggesting that he knows that happened or didn't happen. I think the problem is nobody knows at this point.
Well, that's
right?
Correct. I'm operating on the same base of information that the auditors had, which is fundamentally the records that they had at the time.
And of course, we are also one of the complications in this case is that we have a 3-year record-keeping requirement, and we're past that 3-year point for some of these transactions. So that does make it more complicated to have a record-keeping finding, which is why...
For the five-year statute of limitations, yes.
Yes, I know. I have long been of the opinion that we really... Those two provisions ought to be matched up, that, you know, if there's a five-year statute of limitations, there ought to be a five-year record-keeping requirement, because otherwise, what do we do in those last 2 years? It's a conundrum.
Yeah, and then where does the burden of proof lie? Mm-hmm.
Yes, because it is, at least in the first instance, the obligation of the committee to maintain records. Mm-hmm. It's not our obligation to maintain records. We would have no means of doing that. But
I'm just saying there is no record-keeping rule on an oral designation. I'm not aware of one.
It could be oral, but as I said, it does not appear to me that that argument is actually being made by the committee, that, you know, we believe there were such oral designations. I think, to the contrary, where we are is nobody knows. Nobody knows at this point. And then, you know, where does that leave us? So putting aside the three-year record-keeping requirement problem, where we have a regulation that requires some designation, What would be the evidence? The problem is an absence of information. In this case, or put it more generally, in any case, where there is a complete absence of information, under what circumstances would we ever have evidence that something didn't happen? We only have evidence that something does happen. How would one ever prove that there was no designation?
If a donor were to come up later and say, those dirty, rotten scoundrels, no, why did they put my money into that federal account? I didn't support their efforts. I didn't even like that U.S. Senate candidate. I wanted to help our governor candidate. Why did they put my – that's one way to prove it.
Right.
And apparently none of that arose here.
Yeah. Well, there have been enforcement actions where, in fact, I mean, you've had that happen, where, for example, mainly involving joint contributions to the federal and non-federal account, where on the back end, unbeknownst to the donor, the recipient splits the contribution. That's happened in your investigations before.
Commissioner Peters?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In thinking about this issue, I mean, the question that comes to my mind is, in a situation where we have here, where it sounds like most of the monies were in the first bucket, written out to the Democratic Party of Illinois, the checks, with no further designations. I believe that's what your representation was, is that that's
correct.
Seems to be the case. And at this point, we don't know a lot about whether or not there were handshake agreements and so forth, just because of it's several years ago, and memories could be fuzzy, records could have been lost. But so we have checks that were written out to the Democratic Party of Illinois from permissible sources and in amounts that comply with the act, and without any evidence, again, of intent to mislead, or, again, that there are no impermissible funds or any prohibited sources. At this point, what interest is being advanced by a very rigid application of this rule? You know, just even setting this, you raised the McCutcheon issue, but without even getting into the constitutional dimension right here, I'm just not sure at that point. I don't think it's sufficient just to say that we have to protect the integrity of the regulation for the regulation's sake by itself. There has to be some interest beyond that. And under those circumstances, I'm just not sure that we have a very strong interest at that point. And so I think that this rule is on the books, and I think it needs to be enforced. I think it needs to be enforced with a remembrance of why it was put on the books in the first place. Mr. Swoboda has mentioned to us the circumstances that gave rise to the drafting of this rule, and those are the sorts of circumstances that we need to keep in mind. I just don't see those here, and in the absence of evidence of that sort of a circumstance, I just don't think an overly rigid application of that rule advances much of a legitimate interest.
We're coming to the close of our 30 minutes, but Commissioner Walther?
I was just going to ask Commissioner Peterson, what do you suggest we do?
What do we say?
Well, I mean, if you don't want a rigid, enforcement or interpretation of this, what do you suggest you do in this case? I mean, I see a request that it's a polite chastisement would work as long as it was not a fear that we were going to go ahead and formally enforce.
I'd say that rather than rigid, I'd say let's make a reasonable interpretation of what went on here. What we see here is what are we dealing with? $1.1 million overall, and $75,000. The remainder went to the non-federal account. We see $75,000 that went into the federal account, and we have some evidence suggesting that that relying on the batch deposit notations isn't a very that it has its flaws in terms of knowing where these monies came from. The Janssen fundraiser being the case in point that that Mr. Swoboda brought up. So there is the possibility that some of these checks were actually did have some sort of a designation, whether oral or otherwise, to go into the federal account. And what I don't see here is any evidence that there was
any wrongdoing,
a problem going the other way. And if there were something that were cutting the other way, then I think that I might look at this a little bit different, but I just don't see it here. And so that's why I use the term rigid as opposed to what I'd like to say. I think we need to look at this with some
practicality.
With some sensitivity also to the regulatory burdens that are faced by state and local parties, and what interest is being advanced. Let's be honest. I mean, the regulatory weight that McCain-Feingold opposed on political actors, I think, has been borne disproportionately by state and local parties. And I think that to the extent that we can, vindicate the interests that the Act was designed to vindicate, while at the same time interpreting our own rules in a way that I don't think undermines those interests, but also gives a little breathing room to state and local parties, I don't think is a bad outcome.
We're to the end of our allotted time, but Commissioner Hunter.
I agree with what Commissioner Peterson said, but I think we should look at this. I thought Mr. Swoboda was at the beginning, talking about state parties in general, and then we come to find out that he wants to make sure he doesn't go to enforcement for his client, which I don't blame you. But I do think that we have a responsibility to do something here that speaks not just to the circumstances here, but does, in fact, help not just the Illinois Democrat Party, but other state parties know what to do. I frankly didn't realize that this was an issue, because I think it's very common that people are handing out checks, to events that aren't specifically in response to a specific fundraiser. I probably shouldn't say what I witnessed last weekend, but I think it happens fairly often. And so I think we should say something even more broadly than what Peterson's suggesting, and do something that's more applicable to other state parties as well.
I think it cries out for rule of practicality. If there are no further questions, Mr. Swoboda, you have 10 minutes, and you'll have the last word today.
Well, remembering an admonition I heard earlier, I'm going to try to be clear, be persuasive, and be brief. First off, in response to Commissioner Hunter, I wish I represented every state party in America, or at least all of the Democratic state parties. And I am here just on behalf of this one particular client. But it is an important issue for state parties generally. And here we're in a situation that's especially apt with this party that's so heavily non-federally focused. You begin with the McCain-Feingold restrictions, which you're charged with enforcing until you're told that you can't, requiring that federal election activity be paid in the first instance entirely with federal money, maybe in some instances paid with a mix of federal and Levin money. You have state parties that on top of that, and in fact because of that, are dealing with compliance burdens that far surpass those of any other entity that you regulate. So from your website last night, in 2010 thus far, you've disclosed 21 audits of unauthorized committee, 10 of them, or 21 of unauthorized committees, 12 audits of unauthorized committees, and 9 of them are political party committees, state and local political party committees. In 2008, you had 28 audits of unauthorized committees that you've disclosed and published to date, and 18 of them are of state and local party committees. So they're dealing in the first instance with the McCain-Feingold restrictions. They're dealing with the requirement, in the case, for example, of this party that wants to support state legislative candidates, that wants to support its down-ballot candidates, is required to pay for some, if not all of that, in many circumstances, with federal money. And now the question is whether the commission's going to interpret this rule to say that you can't even use this federal money that you've otherwise raised, that's otherwise within the limits, that's otherwise within the restrictions, to pay for the non-federal activity that Congress has told you you have to pay for federally. I mean, so it is the worst of all worlds. I mean, not only are you in a more complicated regulatory scheme than anyone else, not only do you face finance burdens for the purely non-federal conduct of activities that others don't have to face, but you face another burden of being able to accumulate the federal funds that you need to pay for those very same non-federal activities. So that's why I'm here really urging, I think, what would be a rule of reason in the application of the 102.5 requirement. First, I'm cheered to learn from the hearing that that is the remaining issue that we're talking about. That's very good news from our perspective and an appropriate, I think, culmination to our desire to cooperate with this process, you know, before. But in the application of this rule, is it going to be enforced in such a way that's going to put the last insuperable burden on a party to accumulate the federal money it needs to pay even for non-federal activity? And the rule says what the rule says. I'm not telling the commission that it can disregard the rule or that it ought to disregard the rule. But the question is how aggressively, how narrowly is the commission going to interpret the rule to impose an actual refund requirement from the federal account where there's no question of a violation of the limit or restriction, there's no question of violating donor intent, there's no other question about the eligibility of the funds. And in that case, I think the commission, within the permissible bounds of the rule, needs to give a wide berth. And this is where there is a fundamental difference between the audit process and the enforcement process. And it's inevitable. It in no way, you know, speaks poorly of the audit division or the task that they need to do, because it's what auditors do. You assume a world of non-compliance, and from that you identify the compliance that you have, and what's left goes into the audit report that comes to the commission. So you begin by presuming things are bad, and you try to establish what of that you can prove is good. And while that's appropriate in an audit setting, in normal audit circumstances, it lends itself poorly to actual enforcement of the campaign finance laws in situations where penalties are imposed or people bear the public burden of being told that they have failed to comply with the law, because in the application and enforcement of the campaign finance laws, the burden is different. You start, for example, in your normal enforcement process with the burden to find reason to believe that a violation has occurred, which is something more than, but we can't prove that it didn't. And so I think that causes the commission at this point in the audit process, and particularly with this issue of 102.5 and how state parties finance the federal component of their activities, to have some rule of reason and some wider berth for state parties as they accumulate these permissible federal funds. It's good that the commission is focused on state party issues and is going to hear more about them in different contexts, you know, the month after next. I would hope that this is among the sorts of subjects that one will hear from, you know, with state parties, which really are increasingly, you know, dealing with these sorts of burdens above and beyond, you know, the regulatory community. And their the application of this provision in this particular way in this context is very injurious to this particular client, particularly given their non-federal focus. And I appreciate the commission's time and attention.
Mr. Svoboda, thank you. It's been a very helpful presentation, and I want to thank you for bringing it to our attention. I hope you will return in June and bring some of this issue and or others back to our attention. This concludes, Vice Chair Rattle, would you
Can I just ask a question in process?
since he is going to submit additional information, mm-hmm. What is the process going forward from there?
We will receive a draft final audit report. We take no action here today. He's right.
I understand.
And I take it that our audit staff has found your presentation quite helpful as well. So, Mr. Svoboda, thank you. This concludes the audit hearing for the Democratic Party of Illinois, and we'll take a 10-minute recess and return for the commission's open meeting. Thank you, sir.